and you're listening to the Parallax Podcast. My name is Luke Buckmaster. I'm joined by my esteemed co-host, Mr. Rich Harrity.
That's me. Hello.
Hello, Rich. We've got a jam-packed program for you this fortnight, as we do every fortnight. We're just in the lead-up to Christmas at the moment, Rich. Are you preparing? You're stuffing your stockings? What are you doing?
Yeah, my stockings are getting stuffed.
Yeah.
And my
is that a euphemism?
My Christmas tree is getting decorated.
And we're approaching the Boxing Day releases, obviously. By approaching, we've got a little bit to go. But we've got a really terrific program planned for you next Parallax Podcast too. But not that this one is going to be bad, but the next one's going to be really, really good. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be this Christmas and festivities.
So if you want to stop listening now and skip to the next episode.
Do not listen.
Yeah.
But for now, maybe you do want to listen. And we're going to be reviewing two films at the cinema. First, The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
And second, we'll be talking about The Sessions.
And on DVD, currently available or soon to hit your shelves, is Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
And The Campaign, a comedy.
It's a very succinct review.
I know.
And then we will be inviting our fantastic cult film expert, Zach Hepburn, to tell us about a very weird cult film. Don't know what he's got in store for us this week.
I have no idea.
It's going to be strange.
It might be pretty normal. You never know. He could throw a curveball.
It could be Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
One day we'll
he
talk
might do
about
it.
Chitty
might
Chitty
do
Bang
it.
Bang.
But a version where like it shows you the film in reverse and upside down.
Is that how you'd really want to see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
I'm just saying maybe that's what Zach would prefer in his infinite wisdom.
Well, let's think about that and talk about Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Raise your glasses to Charlie.
What did I do?
You didn't do anything. We just want to toast our new friend. You see things, and you understand. You're a wallflower. What is it? What's wrong?
I didn't think anyone noticed me.
Well, we didn't think there was anyone cool left to meet.
Well, it's not easy being a teenager. It wasn't for Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye. It wasn't for the geeky overachiever in The Breakfast Club. It wasn't for the cast of Nightmare on Elm Street. It wasn't easy for me. Rich, it wasn't easy for you.
Hi.
It was quite easy for Rich. And cinema understands that people go through issues. The Perks of Being a Wallflower explores angsty high school adolescence. Treads some pretty familiar territory. You've got a quiet kid who gets new powers. You've got the awkwardness of a first girlfriend. You've got a gay friend who tussles with his sexuality. There's some drug experimentation and so forth. Yet this film, starring Logan Lerman, just rolls off the tongue, that Logan Lerman,
great name.
A.K.A. Percy Jackson from Percy Jackson the Lightning Thief. He plays the quiet protagonist, thus the word wallflower in the film's title. And it manages to hold its own despite, shall we say, some brand familiarity. Emma Watson, who played Hermione in the Harry Potter movies, plays the object of his affection, but it's not a straight-up rom-com. Wallflower's formulaic elements are certainly here and present, but they're offset by an unexpected excursion into some darker elements, mostly concerning mental illness, plus even an occasional moment of visual panache. It's nothing to write home about, but it's a decent film, certainly above average. It's got heart and a bit of courage, and maybe quite good for a DVD watching, Rich.
Yeah, well, it's a good coming-of-age film, for sure, but let's put good in quotation marks.
I'm doing the
quotation marks because it plays to convention so madly at times that it did feel like kind of a fill in the blanks template was used to put this film together. I felt that it never really transcended its convention. And I also had problems with this weird reverential nostalgia that the film presented us with. It's set in 1991. But it's packed with all these early 80s references that felt like a proto-hipster film that showed how youth fantasizes a culture just out of its reach. I mean, there's Rocky Horror references, The Smiths, Bowie, old typewriters. I could just go on and on. And I felt that was really kind of odd and jarring to see a film so distinctly set in 1991, but set around a culture of kids that were living in the early 80s. It didn't work.
I didn't think about that. It does seem a bit odd, these references. It was based on a book, Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Yes,
based on a book. I'm not sure
written
when the book is set or if it has
it's 1991. It's written and directed by the author of the book.
Yeah.
So it's obviously a personal film for him.
And he's kept all the details, so that doesn't really explain the different cultural references and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I just apart from the conventionalness, you did point out these weird excursions that the film has into kind of mental illness and other things, and they didn't really work that well for me. There's a final act bomb that's dropped into the narrative that really bugged me. And it's well foreshadowed throughout the whole film, but I don't think it was earned that well. It retroactively put a lot of the concerns I had about the central character's behaviour into perspective, but it's a type of gambit that I think works better in a novel than a film. It just felt like all of a sudden this event was thrown up into the story that just, it didn't come out of the blue, but it just didn't work for me. It kind of annoyed me.
Yeah,
it
didn't really bother me so much. I thought it was an evasive kind of portrait of mental illness. Like the protagonist has these issues, and there's a couple of references to, you know, a best friend and an auntie and a family member and stuff like that. And you're never really quite sure what his problem is.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting way to kind of anchor the film. And I think that kind of feeds into what you're saying about how even at the end, you're kind of not sure where that came from, if that was really sat well. I think you're probably right. It didn't completely come together. But on the other hand, it gives the film a bit of an edge or a bit of a gravity that other films of its kind just don't have or don't aspire to.
Oh, it definitely is one of the few things that is kind of out of the conventional framework of the film. But it didn't play that well for me in the end. And I understand that these types of films aren't made that often anymore. These kind of non-ironic, authentic kind of teen coming of age films.
Yeah.
And I think kind of 15 to 25 year olds will eat this film up.
Yeah, I think so too.
Like, and I think it works really well. It's effective in conveying what it wants to do. I just don't think it's particularly groundbreaking or interesting.
It's not. It could have done with some scabby jeans in the jean pool in terms of the cast and the actors. They look a bit too clean cut.
Yeah.
You know, it could have, if Judd Apatow sort of did this film, and you might have had a Jonah Hill or Seth Rogen, that sort of guy or girl, and it's a bit sort of fresh-faced and kind of glossy. But yeah. And Joan Cusack's in it for about 2 minutes.
Well, that was weird. I remember her name pops up in the credits, but she doesn't appear until the last 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of, it was really jarring to see that happen. I think
Ezra Miller,
who plays the gay friend in the film, who you'd probably remember from We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Yeah.
He's actually really kind of charming and good and brings a lot of energy
and
to it. Eerily,
he looks quite a lot like Michael Jackson in this film, doesn't he? Like a young Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I can see that, okay.
But always white.
A young white Michael Jackson.
Yeah, which of course never happened.
No.
But so he has a marketable point of differentiation.
Because he's the white young...
I think.
There you go, the perks of being a wallflower, starring a young white Michael Jackson.
What do you mean, have sex?
Well, when a man and a woman love each other very
much. No, I understand what are we talking about sexual intercourse?
I think so.
Outside marriage?
I did do my best on the question of marriage.
What's the difference between this sexual specialist and the common prostitute?
I don't know, but I think there's a difference.
The Sessions is a dramatically inert, feel-good film that offers up a strange blend of frank sexuality and vanilla sentimentality. Mark O'Brien is an affable, wisecracking cripple, whom everybody loves. Mark has one problem, though. He's a 38-year-old virgin, and his one dream is to pop his cherry. In between cracking jokes with his cat and embarrassing his hip local priest, Mark begins a series of sessions with sex therapist Cheryl, played by Helen Hunt, in a performance that will be labelled by many as brave, which is critic code for she gets naked a lot. That's a film in a nutshell. There's literally nothing more to it. There's no especially
rich... brave in the shower all the time.
There's no especially rich insight into the life of the disabled. And whilst the sessions themselves are refreshingly candid, everything else about the film is remarkably bland. Most bothersome is Australian writer-director Ben Lewin's attempt to give the narrative a backbone by suggesting that Cheryl does develop feelings for Mark, which to me changes the character from a professional therapist to a weak-willed woman who can't help but fall for this charming paraplegic. In fact, everyone in the film falls for the charms of Mark by the climax. The Sessions resembles a eulogy where one dares say a bad word about the deceased. The film is well-acted and everyone is incredibly sincere, but damn, this film is exasperatingly slight. Luke?
Oh, Rich. What do you expect of the eulogy? Like, it's not the sort of venting your frustrations with someone. Never mind. What I thought when you were saying this film review was that the 38-year-old version, Mark O'Brien, in this film, could team up with the 40-year-old version.
Oh my God.
Steve Carell, and they could have a hybrid film excursion where they both go out and try and pick up women.
So they're just like wheeling Mark around wheeling, and Steve Carell's running around, and it's like who can score first?
Because Mark's great as a poet. He's got some awesome lines. In fact, I wrote a couple of them down. I found the sound of her peeing very erotic. By the time she came back, I had an incredible boner.
Wow, that's profound.
Everything is good except for the ears. It seems sort of necessary to contextualize that a bit.
Yeah.
Her fleshy legs drove me to ecstasies of despair.
Oh, ecstasies of despair.
And all these other much better lines are the ones I wrote down. This guy was a poet. I think you're being much too hard on this. What I was quite afraid of or concerned of before I saw the sessions was that it was going to be just this massive Oscar bait session and reeking of Oscar bait. And, you know, they should have had the words "for your consideration" just emblazoned in a massive watermark on the screen.
You didn't feel that was the case?
Well, maybe for the performances, but I think the rhythms of this film are much more contained than most Oscar kind of bait films are. And it's very kind of personal and very insular. And a slightly kind of daring in its own way. I think it's a film with a good heart, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think it comes together quite well. But having said what you said, I would also call it very slight.
Yeah, well, I mean, the filmmaker, Ben Lewin, himself was a polio sufferer as a child. And the main character is a paraplegic because of polio. And that's where kind of Ben Lewin found the connection in wanting to make the film. And there's definitely a sincerity to the film, and it's got such a strong positive intention behind it, but there's just nothing to this film.
Oh, I disagree.
There's no dramatic edge, and everyone is
it's funny. It's more of a comedy about exploring sexuality in the context of somebody who just doesn't have the same opportunities as everybody else. And I think that's why this film has been championed in the kind of disability sector, because you know, you do have the kind of sexual progression of someone who just doesn't seem to be built for sex but has the instincts of everybody else.
But there's no... I understand that it's kind of like maybe eye-opening to some people that people with those types of disabilities have sexual urges. But is that all this film?
No, I think it's more than that.
Well, what is it? Because like, there's no insight into his life at all. There's all these sequences of him home alone in his iron lung. And he's cracking jokes with his cat. His cat's just wandering around and he's talking to his cat and cracking jokes about how he's going to get laid tomorrow at his session. And it's like, what the hell am I watching?
You try spending all but 4 hours a day inside a massive iron lung, this metal box that help you breathe. And I'm sure if you did, you would be talking to inanimate objects. So he's having a bit of a convo with the cat.
Yeah, but
that's fine.
But I didn't feel it
works in service of a larger kind of portrait of his character, which I think is a nice character.
It's nice. Everything about this film is nice.
No, but I think he's fairly detailed in a way too as a character. I mean, you know, you learn a bit about his life.
A very small amount. I learn that everyone falls in love with him. Like,
no, it's not true. If you remember, he gets his heart broken in this film, Rich.
Yes.
He gets his heart broken. In fact, maybe even a couple of times.
Yes, but...
In fact, the film doesn't actually, in terms of the real life story, the film actually doesn't even focus on the love of his life. On the actual person that Mark O'Brien married and fell in love with is actually out of the scope. Almost out of the scope completely of this film.
Yeah, there's almost a better, more interesting film in that.
Perhaps a more conventional film, though, about him meeting, falling in love and getting married.
Well, this might be unconventional, but I don't think it's successful at all. But look, people are liking this film, I gotta say. Like, it received one of the biggest rounds of applause when I saw it at the Melbourne Film Festival that I've ever seen at a film festival. It's a very crowd-pleasing film, but it's a very vanilla one-dimensional film.
No, I disagree. I think it's got dimensions, and I think it's nice and well made and relies on good performances.
I'd like you to chop this tree down with a single swing.
That tree? It's got to be more than a foot across. That's impossible.
But it isn't a tree. It's what you hate most in the world. So tell me, Mr. Lincoln, what do you hate?
I hate that my mother was taken away.
Inadequate.
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Well, that's probably the perfect high concept title. In four words, you know pretty much what to expect. You can write on the back of a matchbox. I don't know why you would. In this latest experiment in trying to generate fun and laughs by joining two seemingly incompatible narratives, young Liam Neeson lookalike Lux Haney Jardine stars as, sounds a bit like sardine, stars as the real quote unquote Abraham Lincoln, who became a vampire hunter after his mum was murdered by a bloodsucker many, many moons ago. He takes tutorials from a mentor. And this guy wears sunglasses that look like they were plucked out of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from the year 3059 and proceeds to kick some ass. There were some really good opportunities to draw some correlations between the anti-abolitionist and the slavery movement, but the film chickens out of virtually anything interesting. The director understands that when expectations are this low, the trick is to keep the action fast and snappy, but it doesn't even pull that off. Having said that, if you do keep your expectations low, some of the action scenes are okay, and there's loopy dialogue that will appeal and maybe, just maybe, get this one across the line.
Yeah, maybe. I think you said it best when you said the title says it all, because this, if you come to a film titled Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, you kind of expect there to be an Abraham Lincoln character, and he kills some vampires.
Yeah, there'll be very few walkouts, I imagine.
No, this film gives you exactly what you expect from the title,
yeah,
and nothing else.
Yeah.
I found, especially the first half of the film, really, really boring. And I hate using the term boring because it's like a vague and lazy shorthand term that doesn't mean too much. But there was nothing happening interesting in the first half of the film. For 50 minutes, it's just a guy learning to kill vampires and he meets a chick. And when the film actually gets to his period as Lincoln as president, it actually becomes,
picks up some pace.
Yeah, it becomes quite interesting. I think the ideas in the second half are reasonably interesting, especially the proposition that the slave trade kept the vampires under control because the vampires were using slaves as food. And so by freeing the slaves, Lincoln was actually fighting the vampires, and the Emancipation Proclamation was an order to stop slaves being used for food. And this type of historical,
they chicken out of actually showing you the slaves.
They don't go all the way, and they start to use kind of historical detail in interesting ways by reframing the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And the Confederates are kind of vampires. And I liked these details, but the film does nothing with them. So even though the second half of the film is more interesting than the first half, it's still just a really straight down the line, kind of boring film.
It's pretty trashy. I like maybe a couple of the inventions. I like the fact that the character carries around pockets full of sand so that he can throw at air lest vampires around him turn invisible. And there's one kind of cool chase scene that's based on top of horses.
Yes,
you know that? And they run across the horses, which I've never seen before. And then there's a sort of burning train scene that's kind of okay as well. But it's,
well, what got me beer through and Skittles the, kind of stuff. The visual stylistics was what got me through. And can you tell me the director's name again?
Like, I'm being set up here.
Yeah, what was his name?
Timur Bechtnebekov.
Yep. Him. I like him as a filmmaker. His last film, I think, was Wanted. I really enjoyed. I really liked Wanted. Yep. He's a really kind of nice, visual, kinetic filmmaker. And there's some moments in the film that are visually interesting and I think work really well. But this was just me scraping at whatever I could to keep my attention to make it through to the end. Basically going, oh, that was a nice shot. That was a nice sequence. Because there really was nothing more than Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter going on.
Well, that's the thing. It's part of this movement, which has largely been in literature, like trashy literature, of conjoining these seemingly incompatible narratives like Pride and Prejudice and zombies and Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters.
Does that exist? Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters?
In book form. Wow. Yes.
Cool.
So I was thinking maybe you could do The Remains of the Day in Godzilla. my brilliant career in rapists. I don't know.
What? No. Where did that come from?
I read it on the internet somewhere. I think if you keep expectations low, maybe this one would work for you.
It might pass the time. If the title appeals to you, then you know what you're in for.
The guys are prepared to donate $500,000 to your pack, provided, of course, you pick up the phone anytime we call.
Oh, hold on. Hello, how about 750?
If you give us $1 million, hell, I'll let you sleep with my wife.
And for 1.5, I'll throw my cousin.
I don't know if you want her cousin. That might drive the price down.
No, she lost weight.
Oh, Mrs. Brady, are you playing footsie with me under the table?
Nope, that's me.
He's a switch hitter.
No, I did once. I did once in college, yes, which we've never talked about.
The Campaign is the type of film that Will Ferrell and his mates can make in their sleep. Get a broad concept and improvise a few scenes. Bingo, you've got a feature film. It's essentially a series of sketches centered around the idea of two inept politicians running against each other for office. Zach Galifianakis plays Ferrell's opposition and does a decent job, but the film never really soars, but rather it settles for an amiable series of set pieces that raise a mediocre amount of giggles. The big problem behind the film for me falls onto director Jay Roach's shoulders. Roach began his career directing the Austin Powers films and became a force in American comedy, but he never really did much other than launching the Meet the Parents films. His last film, Dinner for Schmucks, was as uninspired as this one, and whilst Ferrell can be hilarious when unleashed, I think he relies greatly on the directors he's working with. Adam McKay, his Anchorman and Step Brothers collaborator, seems to definitely bring out the best in him. In the end, The Campaign is a brisk 90 minutes of passably amusing crude humour that probably works better on DVD when you can just chuck it on in the background and only pay attention occasionally. Did you find the film more entertaining than me?
Oh, I thought it was pretty funny. Yeah, really? I thought it was pretty funny. If you go in expecting a political comedy, I think you're going to be very disappointed.
I didn't expect a political
comedy.
No,
I'm not saying you did, but it's a broad kind of character comedy, and if you want political satire, this is obviously not the place to find it. But if you do want shots of Will Ferrell punching a baby and the dog from The Artist, this is where you go.
I gotta say, I did like the running jokes of Will Ferrell punching stuff, and when he punched the dog from The Artist, I gotta say, that personally,
it's funny. It's very funny, and this politician's career sort of plummets into controversy, and everything starts to go wrong for him after he calls the wrong number and leaves this very lewd message on the answering machine to this conservative Christian family with kids around the dinner table. Yeah. It's quite funny.
It becomes so absurd, though, as it goes along, and it kind of reaches a point where it's gone too far to even keep believability in terms of the fact that this would be a real election.
Well, the funny thing is, like, the characters, you think, oh, these guys are too ridiculous to be politicians. Then you remember Sarah Palin and Herman Cain, and, you know, like they're not even stupid enough now. Like, those real politicians are beyond parody. Like, you put them in the film, they're going to look ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how they look in this film. So I don't think the characters are that wrong. I think Jay Roach is a fairly middle-of-the-road director, but I think this is one of his probably better films. I mean, it's not great, but I think it's quite a bit of fun. Unfortunately, they've sort of tacked on this kind of moral ending. Just like sort of tacked it on, and it would be a much more cynical piece if they didn't just sort of crowbar that in at the end.
Well, that whole idea that they take on, which mirrors reality, it's kind of got to do with the people that fund the people that are up for election. So these kind of shady rich entrepreneurs, John Lithgow and Dan Aykroyd play these two kind of rich entrepreneurs that are funding this,
almost
this,
like supervillain characters, yeah, like ridiculous and people.
The film, I guess, is trying to make a satirical stab at real life and the Koch brothers and those types of big, rich, billionaires that fund these things. But you're right; it didn't need that big kind of moral at the end of the story where everyone gets theirs, and it didn't even earn that.
Yeah, didn't earn it at all. But the audience don't necessarily want that.
Well, they don't want that. They just want the jokes. Yeah. And on a joke level, I don't think this film really filled the gaps for me. It didn't...
I disagree. I think that the jokes roll off the assembly line pretty well. And as you said, Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis, they can kind of do this in their sleep. But they're always quite funny. And it reminded me of those two guys meeting in the online show Between Two Ferns.
Yeah,
put those guys together and they're always going to be pretty amusing.
Well, that's interesting because I am a big fan of Galifianakis. His Between Two Ferns work and his stand-up work is hilarious. I don't think he's ever been used in film that well.
Oh, The Hangover used him well.
I think barely. I actually think he hasn't...
He's used him well.
I don't think he's translated his comedy to film successfully yet. I just think it's waiting to happen, and I think that people are struggling with finding a role for him.
The Galifianakis explosion yeah. of comedy is waiting to happen.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, if YouTube some of his stand-up work...
Yeah, no, I've seen a lot of stuff.
Between Two Ferns videos, they're hilarious.
No, they are very, very funny. It's just hard when you sort of plant that stuff into a narrative and
yeah.
cast him in character. And he's sort of done this character before on Between Two Ferns. He's very effeminate, sort yeah. of conservative kind of guy. Reminded me of Jack Black's Bernie character. I think there's some... Similarities, I can totally see
Galifianakis doing yeah. the Bernie role. That's an interesting
almost
comparison.
Like sexually confused,
yeah.
kind of good-hearted, wholesome, white bread people.
Yeah, well, I think Galifianakis's best work is still ahead of him.
Yeah,
I think The Campaign. It's just a film that, yeah, like I said, they could make in their sleep. It's, you know, you know what you're going to get. It's like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. It's like you know what you're going to get when you press play on this, and it'll pass 90 minutes of your time amiably.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, you're listening to the Parallax Podcast, and we're in the dungeon, the depths of despair, of our man, our cult film guru.
Yes, we are.
His name is Zach. Got the heart of a young boy in a jar on my desk, Hepburn.
Wow. Where is it?
Where's it gone?
That's not too bad.
And can I just say, I actually pilfered that line. It's a Stephen really? King line. He once said, I'm not a monster, to paraphrase him, I've got the heart of a young boy in a jar on my desk. I thought that's a great quote from Stephen King.
And did he also say once, I like children, especially if they're well done?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Moving on, we're not interviewing Stephen King, are we, Rich?
No, we're not.
No, we're not.
Yes.
Stephen King's not available, but Zach Hepburn is.
Hello. I'm always available for children's parties and bar mitzvahs.
And what's your going rate?
A bit of cake.
Party for cake. You're a Pavlova man or a lemon meringue?
No,
or
I'm a bundt pudding. I'm a sort of bundt cake.
A what one?
Bundt cake.
A bundt cake?
Bundt.
Bundt cake.
What's bundt tinned?
They give you in like the tins.
Yeah, a bundt cake.
They store for like 6 months or something?
I'm the lonely guy.
Okay. Anyway, yeah.
Fascinating. I was riveted to that conversation.
We should move on. Okay.
What do you have for us today, Zach?
I have a film which we have been threatening
yes.
to look at
yes.
all year.
And by what have you got? You mean you?
But the royal we.
What? Just spit it out. Just spit it out. What like do you have?
We're going to be looking at Harmony Korine's Trash Humpers, a 2009 film shot on VHS, and it features a group called the Loser Gang Cult Freak Collective, and primarily based in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, Richie, you look a little bit upset.
A little bit.
Oh, are you part of the Loser Gang, whatever it was, collective?
I'm just gonna be over here for a bit because I hate this film.
Okay, he's moved meters really, away.
He's gone into the
in one hand and the other hand has got a mug of caffeinated alcohol.
No, it's alcohol liqueur in both these glasses because I don't want to have a part in talking about one of the worst films I've ever seen in my life. Continue.
This
Zach.
Is the first walk-off in the Parallax.
This is
the
walk-off. It's a walk-off.
And
it's,
what a moment. So, Trash Humpers.
Trash Humpers.
I have not seen this film. Please let me know what
for anybody that's not really familiar with Trash Humpers, it is roughly about a 80-minute film which follows the exploits...
79 minutes too long!
Touché. follows the exploits of a group of... it's two males and one female. They may or may not be wearing old people's masks.
What?
They have kind of like distorted...
Like the Richard Nixon sort of mask?
Yes, sort of, but like with kind of rouge and kind of like contorted lipstick over their face. They wander around like desolate locations, generally like kind of like car parks or bus shelters or abandoned houses, and they just break stuff.
They smash stuff.
They smash stuff and say...
They make jokes while they're doing it?
They might say limericks, I believe. They don't really speak in any intelligible form. Rich has fallen over.
Yeah, he's
down.
Convulsing, but he's... Amazingly, he's holding both glasses.
Still got the drinks. It's yeah. okay.
So do they sort of... is there a narrative, I guess? Or is there a story?
There's no narrative. This is a film If you're familiar with the J.G. Ballard novel, The Atrocity Exhibition...
I haven't read that, but I have read some J.G.
There is a...
It's on your shelf, actually.
The idea of The Atrocity Exhibition is a book that you can
Which
walk...
Which is back.
It's back. Back. He's come back. I said J.G. Ballard, and he's back. Okay. You can walk in and
J.G. Ballard found the house.
Oh. You can walk in and out of The Atrocity Exhibition and pick it up at any time. Very similar to Trash Humpers in a way, in my professional opinion, Mr. Harry, in that you can walk into Trash Humpers at any point and view it for what it's worth. It's small vignettes of absurdity, in my opinion. It is a museum piece of cinema, very reminiscent of David Lynch's early kind of physical haptic works.
Look, they're all nice words.
Yeah.
I enjoyed all your words just then. And I think in some ways, how you've described Trash Humpers is pretty spot on. Yeah. It's not a film to be watched at all from start. It's a film to Which one... It's a, film to wonder like past.
It's a film to wonder past.
It's a film to wonder past. Look, if you end up... If you sit in a cinema and you watch this film from beginning to end, it is the most horrible experience you'll ever have in a theatre.
Worse than Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Look, let's not go there.
Okay, different. But different.
If
horses for courses.
If the film was projected onto a wall in a dirty alley, like Harmony Korine originally intended for distributing the film, he intended to make it copies up on VHS and leave them in bus shelters, which I think is a great way to distribute this
film. Well, it was actually kind of conceived on two VHS decks, and then you were supposed to put it together. What, gentlemen, I know that this is not very good for our listeners, but what my two esteemed guests are holding in their hands at the moment is... the VHS copy of Trash Humpers.
From Gary Marshall.
From Gary Marshall.
It's been dubbed over...
What happens is how Harmony Korine would actually distribute this if you purchased it via the official Trash Humpers website is you could buy it on VHS, which Harmony Korine had actually gotten an ex-rental VHS and dubbed it Trash Humpers over it and hand-filthed the cover. The VHS comes in a plastic doggy bag.
How does one, sorry to interrupt, how does one hand filth something?
You're holding it right now.
Oh, so I filthed it.
You filthed it. And he's put stickers and he's made it look generally messy. Look.
Okay.
He says that it's an elaborate portrait of the American landscape. And what I got off on it when I saw it at the Melbourne International Film Festival a couple of years ago is that, for starters, it had at least 30 walkouts, and that's the mark of quality of any film.
I wish that I was at that screening, and I wished I was one of those people that walked out.
And
I suffered through this whole film.
And I have never seen anything quite like Trash Humpers before or after. No. Possibly, in your opinion, that is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, look, I've never seen anything quite like Trash Humpers either, but I would not want to watch 90 minutes of a static shot of a dog turd as well. That wouldn't be exciting cinema, and neither is Trash Humpers.
All we need now is a series of academic classes to write a piece about Trash Humpers. In 40 years, it will be in the canon. Harmony Korine played one of the Trash Humpers himself, so if that's not dedication to your art, I don't know what is. I'm not going to say batshit crazy for this. I'm going to say I've stepped on some batshit and it's annoyingly stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
Yeah,
it's 10.
It gets 10.
And so few people, for a film that is so wildly hated, so few people have actually seen it. So do yourself a favour, get out Trash Humpers if you can find it, or go to your local bus stop and see if you can get it free.
Well, I'm suspicious of any film that's described as a museum piece of cinema. That evokes all the wrong visual.
I would love to try to get you to watch this film. Like, let's see how long you last.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll be right back after this short ad break. And by ad break, I mean some music.
Goodbye. Though up there goes Johnny Appleseed. He might pass by in the hour of need. There's a lot of soul. Drinking from the well. Locked in a factory.
Oh, hello. What? Are you recording?
Yes.
You're listening to the Parallax Podcast. Thank you for staying with us. Rich, you haven't liked... I don't think you've liked any of the films that we've talked about.
No, I've been a bit grumpy, a bit almost Scrooge-like, you could say.
You have been a bit of a Scrooge. Yeah. I see what you did there. You tied into the whole Christmas thing.
Did
the perks of being a wallflower, and you were a bit of a wallflower in that conversation. You just did nothing the whole time. It was me talking. That was my memory of it.
Well,
young Michael Jackson joke, and that was pretty much it.
I appreciated the white Michael Jackson joke, but I was just, I was sitting in the back.
And you weren't seduced, so to speak, by the sessions and the paraplegic... polio-afflicted poet. And John Hawkes has in his film two bulging kind of forked veins.
He does have a bulging forked vein.
It's not about it, they just pop back.
Yeah, yeah. That's
a flashback.
Helen Hunt forks his vein.
Okay, moving on. And on DVD, we had Vampire Slayer and we had The Campaign with Will Ferrell.
Which are two films that you should look out for if you like average films.
That's Rich sounding like a robot. They are two films that you should look out for. Anyway, we'll be back next episode with a bumper Christmas edition.
A bumper Christmas edition.
Bumper indeed. Christmas edition.
Indeed. It is a stocking-stuffed Christmas edition.
See, now he doesn't sound like Scrooge. He sounds like Santa Claus. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you soon.
Ho, ho, ho. Like sheep of the angels riding down the line.